This episode is brought to you by Organic Grower School, offering a holistic crop management series for farmers starting on March 23rd. Learn more at organicgrowersschool.org.
You're listening to Fields, the podcast, with
Melissa Metrick
and Wythe Marshall. On Fields, we're bringing you the stories of people who are working to grow the field of urban agriculture for money, for fun, to feed the hungry, to green the city, or for entirely other reasons. In each episode, we'll delve into one kind of food that's grown in and around New York City or another city, one technology used to grow the food, or one critical element inside of it. Moreover, we'll investigate all the whys behind getting up in the morning and working as a farmer today. You don't need to be a farmer to enjoy this podcast or even a foodie. We're going to tell fascinating stories and break down the realities and possible futures of urban farming to their elements, examining each in turn. One note, we've been working on this podcast now for over a year, taping a lot of interviews with wonderful farmers and other experts. That means that some material predates COVID-19. We're still including it because these conversations are as important as ever, maybe more so. This is the sound of mushrooms growing, well, indirectly. It's Digital Love by Daft Punk, being played on the cello by Andrew Carter. Carter co-founded Smallhold, New York's only certified organic mushroom farm.
Smallhold builds and operates miniature vertical farms that grow different kinds of fancy mushrooms, like oysters and lion's mane, inside restaurants or grocery stores. They're even in Whole Foods, and yet Smallhold is only a couple of years old. You could say it's been a busy time for Andrew. He doesn't get to play the cello as much as he used to. Andrew came to grow mushrooms professionally via plants and ecology in general, but he also came to them via music.
Today, we're going to tell the story of how he became a mushroom farmer in New York City. We're also going to tell the stories of other professional mushroom growers and foragers in the city.
It tastes like jerky. Nice texture.
Okay, to me, it's sort of more like gummy bears.
Okay, so how did Andrew's cello proficiency lead into a new career as a mushroom farmer?
So my father had a house in Westchester, and it's in the base, it's in Mount Kisco. It's a really beautiful house. We were restoring it. It was really falling apart. I was there pretty often, and we had this big basement, and I started growing oyster mushrooms in the basement. It looked crazy. Like, it looked like I was making drugs. There was, like, plastic everywhere. It was, like, a mad scientist lab. This was, like, three years ago. I would bring people, like, I would be, like, fixing the oil tank or something, and people would, like, go down there, and they wouldn't ask any questions, which is the funny thing. I'm like, don't you want to know about it? And they're like, no, no, no. And then I'm like, we're not. These aren't drugs. This is just oyster mushrooms. We figured out a bunch of different stuff, and we're like, you know, figured out that, like, there's a lack of technology, that, like, people want these kinds of things. I was talking to different chefs here in the city, and people were really into the idea. It was around that same time that this group, North Brooklyn Farms, is building their new spot across from their old spot, the Domino Factory. And I went to high school with one of them, Ryan. And so we grabbed a beer, and I was like, this is crazy. Like, can I build a mushroom farm and a fruit farm? And he's just like, yeah, dude, let's do this.
But we wanted to know how Andrew got started. We talked a lot about his time in college studying ecological design with John Todd, who is one of the founders of that discipline. And then he got involved with hydroponic growing, or growing without soil.
Before this, I was consulting on a few different projects, different hydroponic and indoor ag sort of stuff. That's been my background for the last 8 or 9 years now. I had always kind of been interested in the mushroom industry. But what was happening, we would do these analyses for different cities and try to find different markets and understand different crops that would make sense to grow in different cities, and realize that mushrooms had a really good opportunity. Even 3 or 4 years ago, there was an increase in demand in exotics. It's not as much as it is now, but I mean, it's only been increasing since then. And so I've always kind of thought it was interesting. In the U.S., the majority of mushroom production are buttons and portobello and cremini. Yeah. That's mostly done in Pennsylvania. Anything outside of that is considered an exotic, as far as the producers and the buyers are concerned.
Yeah.
So shiitake, oysters, lion's mane, all the stuff that people are actually really into right now, in my opinion, are considered exotics if you're talking to, like, a produce buyer.
We asked Andrew why he thought exotic mushrooms became popular recently.
Vegetarian diets became pretty popular. People are thinking about how to restructure how they eat. I think the big thing that happened over the last couple of years is this like food as medicine trend. And so there were a lot of businesses that came out making like mushroom pills and additives and all this stuff. And it like really brought into the limelight all these other varieties that people could eat.
So what does Smallhold actually make?
What we have are these, we call them growth chambers, but they're small vertical farms that go inside grocery stores and restaurants and allows them to grow really fresh produce on site. And we focus on mushroom production. What it has is a sensor system and a remote management system inside of it. It's this technology that we developed that allows us to remotely do everything. And so we have a system with Whole Foods, for example. Their staff doesn't ever have to look at a screen or understand how to grow anything because it's communicating with us here at our offices, and we can alter any of the recipes if necessary.
And the growth chambers look cool. They really show off mushroom growing visually.
The units have different footprints because we're trying out different sizes. You know, we have the opportunity to test different things. But they have like sort of space age windows. They're generally white. We usually use this kind of nice shiny white plastic on the outside. Think of like an iPod, but for mushrooms. The lights inside are usually blue LEDs, and that's for the mushrooms themselves. They respond really well to that.
So the unit does a lot of work, and Smallhold provides a farming service in a way.
What we do is we centralize we call it the pre-grow, but it's essentially like the first three quarters of growth with farms or with people that already have really large operations. And then we just finish on site. And so we grow the final part where the fresh produce is exposed, and it's where it's really, it's really delicate and it can be damaged. And that means that the food's never damaged in transit. It's really fresh on site. It's all the benefits of being locally grown, but it's more affordable because if you did it all on site, it's really difficult to do anything on a small scale.
But wait, wasn't this a story about cello and how cello playing led to a mushroom farm?
So I grew up playing cello, and I like play cello and have these like YouTube videos and random cello stuff from years ago.
So you were like a cello star? On YouTube?
I don't know if it's a star, but you guys can look it up and you can find my cello chops. This woman reached out, and they're having this wedding in Red Hook, and they're like, "Can you play a Daft Punk song?" And we walked down the aisle on cello, and I was just like, and it was a looping thing, and I was like, well, I don't know if I want to play a wedding. And so I went and reached out to a couple of my friends, but they do all these weddings too, or DJs. And they were like, you just charge whatever. He was calling it something else, but it's like the screw off price, essentially, where you don't want to do it, but if they accept it, then
you're going to make a lot of money.
You got to do it.
Yeah.
And so I was like, okay, like $2,000 to play. It was, I don't know, it's a lot of money. It was on my hand, but it's a lot of money. And I was like, $2,000. And they were like, sure. Like 30 seconds, I play a Daft Punk song and walk down the aisle. They paid me $2,000 and then went and bought a shipping container and then put that at Northbrook Farms.
Find out more at smallhold.com.
Andrew has a pretty pragmatic view of exotic mushrooms, which makes sense. He's been growing them for a long time. He's probably less excited and also less worried about his grows are than when he first started. Regina Bellows, on the other hand, is a newbie shroom farmer. So quick note, Regina is no longer running this farm. This interview is actually a little bit old, but we wanted to include it because we think it gets at some of the really cool themes we're looking at in this episode. Why are people so into mushrooms? How do they go about learning more about growing them? And how does this turn into sort of a business or a lifestyle? So yeah, just keep that in mind and wish Regina all the best in her new pursuits. And thanks a lot.
So I built my farm in the back of a warehouse. It's a 2,000 square foot warehouse, and you basically walk past a wood shop, and a storage space to get to the room in the back. The room is about 300 square feet, and half of that makes up the actual grow room itself. The grow room is completely lined with, you know, water safe material. I'm constantly wiping it down from mold and other things that the mushrooms release, like their spores. They grow on these shelves that I've created out of metal poles. And there's like maybe 6 shelves all the way to the ceiling on either side of the grow room. And the mushrooms sit on the shelves in plastic bags that's full of mycelium. So I poke holes in the bags, and then the fruit of the mycelium comes out, and that's what we eat.
She was actually inspired directly by Smallhold.
I got my hands on some blue oyster mushrooms from Smallhold, and I sort of tore them apart and put them on a pan, and they ended up looking like steak and tasting like, well, they taste like really delicious mushrooms and feeling like calamari in my mouth. And I was just like, love at first taste. What I quickly realized was I couldn't actually buy these mushrooms. So I decided I'll just start a mushroom farm. I'll get a bunch of all-you-can-eat mushrooms for myself.
This was no problem for Smallhold.
I came across them at the Food Loves Tech conference 2 years ago, and I got to see the mushrooms actually growing. One of them, either Adam or Andrew, said, "We just can't grow enough." And I believed him. And actually, he was right. There's more demand than I could supply.
Regina is a DIYer, a true millennial. She left Arizona for New York City, switched careers, and started working in urban farms, and then switched again to be an actual farmer full time.
It was a rabbit hole that I think started with my love for herbal tea. I accidentally fell in love with this specific herbal tea and wanted to grow all of the ingredients in the tea, just as a hobby thing. It's this blend of tea called Brain Buzz, and this woman creates this blend, and I'm just in love with her stuff. She's in Arizona, actually, and it's called Herbescent. But I kind of got into gardening, and because I was in Arizona at the time, it was not easy. Like, I actually discovered I couldn't grow those things. So I ended up on a lot of gardening blogs trying to figure out how to grow these things in the desert. It was hard, and impossible in the end to grow most of them, but this started kind of a rabbit hole where I actually learned about how the bees were dying. And then from there, stumbled across, I think it was actually the agritecture blog. He talked about vertical farms, and I was like, I just saw massive images of massive farms in my mind. And then I ran across another blog that said, no, we're about 100 years out from any vertical farm existing. So I put the whole thing away for like 5 years. And then I happened across an Aero Farms video on my Facebook and just like pivoted careers, drove to New York City.
Wow.
Yeah,
wow.
Within like months, I was like, this is what I'm doing.
Wow.
She built her farm herself with help from her parents.
Basically, I was jobless in January. I decided to start a mushroom farm, and I was looking and looking and looking and looking for space. No one would listen to me. I'm a little girl who wants to grow mushrooms, and they were like, not in my space, little girl. You get your startup out of here. That sounds messy. I was at an open house, Ragtag X, ran into Jonas, who I had volunteered with at Farm One.
He invited
me to a party on his roof where I met a girl and just became friends with her. Get this, like, first friend I make. She invites me over to her house. Her landlord, who owns the building, takes me on the tour, and he shows me this back room, and he's like, I think I'm going to start renting this room out. It was filled with crap. And I was like, you want to rent it to me so I can start a mushroom farm? And he was like, okay. My parents flew out with a suitcase full of tools.
Wow.
We had extra tools because of the wood shop here, which is nice. And they spent 3 weeks with me.
Yeah, you have really cool parents.
Next, Regina had to learn how to farm.
I had read somewhere online that you could do a relatively small mushroom operation and make a profit at it. And I ended up also buying a course that taught me how to start a low-tech mushroom farm. What's really great about that course is once you go through all the modules, you end up having a community of other people that are also starting a mushroom farm all over the world on Facebook. We get to ask each other questions, and you have a lot of questions.
But one question Regina didn't seem to have was why grow indoors? That seemed to sort of answer itself.
I'm an indoor girl.
Okay.
And that's because my passion for urban farming comes from the need to get ourselves off of the off of nature. Like, yeah. We need to quarantine ourselves because we're destroying it. So agriculture, the way we've been doing it, has killed so much wildlife. Mm-hmm. And it's very unsustainable. We are animals that live in boxes in the sky in cities, and we're finding that to be much better for the environment. So we might as well put our food in boxes in the sky in cities.
Except there was another reason why Regina was so into mushrooms. It all came down to taste.
I used to make the most amazing portobello burgers, and that, I think, is what made me really fall in love with mushrooms first. Then I discovered blue oysters and roasting them and caramelizing them so that you get them real hot on one side and real hot on the other and get them off so that they're still nice and, like, calamari-like. But then I discovered roasting, which is the ultimate way to do mushrooms. And now I just roast my mushrooms all the time. Any variety, I chop them all up, roll them in oil, throw them in the oven for about a half an hour. They shrivel and they get kind of crunchy.
Yeah.
I salt them when they come out and it's just like candy. Like, I don't even put them on anything half the time. I just eat them. At the market, I feel like I'm single-handedly educating the public that roasting is better than sautéing.
Why is it? Because it removes the water, so it's a nicer texture?
Yeah, I think so. They become kind of crunchy. So some people don't like mushrooms because they can be slimy if you overcook them on the stove.
Yep.
This is how it goes at the market. I'm like, hi, how are you? How are you planning to cook your mushrooms? And they're like, oh, I'm going to sauté them. And then I say, you should try roasting. This is what I do all day long. This is my job.
So if you want to talk about the best way to cook mushrooms at the market, or bees, Regina knows a lot about bees, you can find her in Park Slope. Follow her on Instagram at @the_farmroom.
This episode is brought to you by Organic Grower School, offering a holistic crop management series for farmers starting on March 23rd. This holistic crop management curriculum and training opportunity is in partnership with Certified Naturally Grown. Growing a viable farm business is sustained by continuous learning of the land and your products. In this workshop series, growers across Southern Appalachia and beyond will gain tools to manage their crop production for whole farm success. Organic Grower School is offering the Holistic Crop Management Training as a 6-part webinar series. It will include a mixture of videos, resources, and live virtual meetings between March 23rd and April 27th. Learn more, meet the instructors, and register now at organicgrowerschool.org.
You're listening to the smooth sounds of Wild Man on the Brillophone. Never heard of the Brillophone? That's because it's an instrument made out of the cheeks of Wild Man Steve Brill. And when I say wild, I don't mean like caveman wild, but he is pre-agricultural in his own words.
Walking to the car, there was about 5 pounds of bluets. It's a blue mushroom, Clatosebe nude. I can show it to you.
Yeah.
In the other room.
We're at Wild Man's house, which doesn't sound very wild, except you can probably hear in the background our other companion, Wisteria. Like Regina, Wild Man has a passion for cooking. It's inspired him to seek out new foods. He also really likes chocolate.
So, wood's ear?
Yeah.
Should I just grab one and
yes,
pop it in?
Yes.
Cool. Thank you so much.
They have like a texture of gummy bears.
Let's try that.
And I've seasoned them with chocolate. I pureed the chocolate with chickpeas, white miso, a few dates, and some pine nuts, and then I baked them.
It's good.
And these are not just edible mushrooms.
No.
I think they're as good as any wild mushroom you're ever going to get.
Steve, or we have to call him Wild Man, is probably the premier forager in New York City. That means he knows where a lot of edible plants and fungi are all over parks and the side of the street and the yard in front of his house.
I do hundreds of tours every right. year, Saturdays, Sundays, and holidays with the public, scouts, teaching farms, museums, nature centers, land trusts.
Melissa and I wanted to know why Wild Man became so wild. How did he learn all about plants and fungi without a formal training?
Well, I was bicycle riding for exercise, and there was these ethnic Greek women, this is in Queens, picking something. I stopped and asked them what they were doing. Unfortunately, I couldn't understand a word. It was all Greek to me. But they did show me grape leaves and managed to convey what they were. And I came home with them and made an unconventional stuffing. And they were delicious. Then I started getting books on wild food, usually written by botanists that wouldn't know what a kitchen was if it fell on their head, with third-hand information, because they didn't forage.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And I had to figure out everything on my own.
And Wild Man really knows his stuff. He's written 5 books on the subject. And when we visit, he's working on an app.
So this is my illustration.
Oh, that's beautiful.
So it has the leaves like the carrot top, and it has a flower called Queen Anne's Lace.
Yes.
In its second year, its first year, spring, early spring and fall, is when you dig up the root.
Wild Man also has a lot of practical tips about poison.
Look how similar it looks to the carrot.
Oh, yeah, it does. Yes. It looks very similar.
If you eat this, it stops your brain from telling your heart to beat.
I guess it's a big deal when you're a forager. You don't want to eat something that's going to make you sick. So he takes us to his collection of mushroom sculptures. It's this big closet. They're all from life samples. So he finds mushrooms in the wild, and then he tries to immortalize them so that he can teach others about them, because mushrooms don't keep very long once you pick them.
These guys... 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, they're amanitas. The amanitas grow on the ground near trees. They're symbiotic with trees.
Okay.
They all have white gills.
Ah.
There's a little space between the gills and the stem. Even though it's in this deadly group, they do eat this in France, and it's apparently one of the few non-poisonous ones.
Huh.
Whether it's the exact same species in North America as it is in Europe is open to question.
Really?
You'd have to do a DNA comparison.
Right. Yes.
Which isn't that hard. You just ask the mushroom to pull down its genes.
Wildman's jokes and snacks never really stop.
Another puffball, another one. This one already... is too mature to eat, and if you squeeze it, spores come out.
Ah, okay.
So when Linnaeus therefore called the genus Lycoperdon, which means wolf fart. People had a sense of humor in the 16th century.
We ask Wild Man about other foragers, and he tells us stories of people he's not friends with, and then he tells us a long whopper about a friend, Joe Brandt, who is currently president of the Connecticut Westchester Mycological Association, acronym COMA.
He's had his adventures too. The guy's name is Joe. So one day he's driving along the road, and suddenly he sees a dead tree on a lawn by a big house covered with about 10 pounds of oyster mushrooms. He says to himself, there must be 10 pounds of oyster mushrooms. I'm going to have them for dinner. He takes out his pocket knife, runs across the lawn, past the house, cuts down the mushrooms, puts them in his bag, and starts driving back home. 5 minutes later, pull over to the side of the road. So state police, he pulls over to the side. Yes, officer, there is. Is there a problem? There sure is. We just got a call from the warden of the state prison, and he saw someone running across his property with a knife.
Huh.
Why were you trying to kill the warden? When did you escape from jail?
Wow.
We're going to take you back. You're not going to get out again. No, it was me, but I wasn't trying to kill anyone. I was just trying to pick these mushrooms. I'm really sorry. all right, I'm going to let you go. Don't ever let that happen again.
Wow.
But 2 weeks go by. It rains like crazy. Mushrooms come up after the rain. And Joe happens to be driving down the same road.
No.
And suddenly on the same log, on the same lawn, by the same house, were 20 pounds of oyster mushrooms. But I don't want to go to prison. They might be worth it. I'd rather just not go to prison. So he knocks on the door. And who should come out but the warden himself? Yes, sir, what can I do for you? Excuse me, I saw all these oyster mushrooms on your dead tree. I know they're edible. Would you mind if I took some home, please? And the warden thinks for a minute, scratches his head, and then a big smile lights up his face. Sure, go ahead. Have all the mushrooms you want. As a matter of fact, it was so nice of you to knock on the door and ask permission. You wouldn't believe the nerve of the last guy who found mushrooms on the
But the forager whom Wildman talks the most about by far is his daughter, Violet.
My daughter went when she was like 8, because she learned all the plants when she was growing up. Like the kid learns cucumbers, she learns wild carrots. She just entered high school. She's been co-leading my tours since she was 9.
Wow.
After the tours. And she finds all the plants faster than I do, and she steals all my jokes.
She was also faster to pick up the Brillophone. You can get in touch with both Brills through wildmansstevebrill.com. Our final story today is of someone growing mushrooms for educational reasons, but also for deeply personal and really big ecological ones. It's kind of really inspiring. Melissa and I both really enjoyed talking with her. You know what? She can say it better than we can.
JJ, will you introduce yourself?
My name is JJ. I grow mushrooms at home.
She would also like to be a mycologist one day, a scientist who studies mushrooms. But for now, she has created a mini lab in her closet. Like Wildman Steve Brill, JJ has some other goals as well.
I guess my mission is to reconnect city people to nature from the mushroom perspective, because that's a lot I think we can learn from mushrooms, fungi, and get inspired.
JJ has a little bit more experience with mushrooms.
Mushrooms have always been in my life, because I grew up in China, and it's never something too special. You know, my mom always cooks different mushrooms. We always have dried mushrooms in our kitchen. And I did my first trip to find mushrooms in a forest more than a decade ago.
Yet just recently, she started to learn how to grow mushrooms.
Last year, I had time to take a workshop with Peter McCoy, who wrote the book Radical Mycology. So at the end of the workshop, every person got to pick 4 liquid cultures. So I got mine and I looked at them. I was like, okay, you're all alive. I cannot kill you. I have to do something. So in mushroom cultivation, we say move it or lose it.
Hmm.
So it's really, for me, it's a responsibility to keep their life going.
JJ has a little bit of a different perspective of mushrooms than our other guests.
I think mushrooms are my boss. I definitely don't think they are just products. I do talk to them.
You do?
I do. I think about like how I got into mushrooms was because I think I started just growing also herbs, like plants. And then I think the whole process, it was like maybe 2-3 years of journey. And it changed how I really look at other creatures. To me, we all belong to this bigger ecosystem, maybe different systems, but now we are in the city, we belong to this city ecosystem. When we go to a forest, it's just like there are a lot of systems, ecosystems mm-hmm. around us. And I don't necessarily see the other animals, plants, fungi being products. You know, we do our own things. Mm-hmm. We may not have the common languages, mm-hmm. but they're just I don't know if equal is the word, but we definitely are connected some way.
Yeah.
Instead of we just manipulate, somehow trigger the environments, feed them so that I can get your fruits.
Yeah.
JJ also connects with people and mushrooms through her workshops.
There are two types. So one is it might be an organization they're interested in getting their audience more familiar with fungi or this world. So I taught a workshop for a group of artists in the past. And then a group of students say they are really interested in future of agriculture.
Yeah, that's what
you're doing. Yeah. So just get them inspired and interested and curious. My goal is really not to dump a lot of information. My goal is to get them so inspired that they want to dig deeper, further.
Yeah. JJ also has what she calls inoculation parties. And sometimes those inoculation parties get a little weird.
We had another inoculation party where we inoculated a brain.
A brain?
It's a brain-shaped mold. And then, so the idea is to make a structure to discover or experiment with the structural ability of fungi to basically to show people another or some other ways to look at fungi.
JJ is hoping to continue her work next year on Governor's Island.
I wrote a proposal for next year. So I want to do, it's an exhibit to show the fungi life cycle. And hopefully people can just look, touch, smell, and play. So right now we're looking for, I need an indoor space.
Yeah.
So still figuring some details out. Yeah. Then we can use that as a platform. Hopefully I can also invite other mushroom peoples meet with and share their own work and projects mm-hmm. To the audience.
Just an update, JJ did have this project on Governor's Island at the Swale House in 2019. And if you'd like to learn more about it, it was called the Intelligent Fungi Series. And of course, we had to ask JJ about her favorite mushroom.
There's a mushroom called paddy straw. I think it's pretty common maybe in Asia. I love it because it reminds me of the chicken soup my mom made.
Oh,
yeah. Because she used to always make the soup and she would throw a bunch of mushrooms in the soup and it was the best.
So what have we learned about people who either forage or grow mushrooms? Why?
They all thought a lot about cooking mushrooms. And I'm not sure how much we're able to capture in the interviews. They also all thought about the environment. And I think they all definitely dealt with the practicalities, the realities of mushrooms and learning a lot about their life cycles, how they kind of act, what they like, don't like. Sort of how to keep them happy, which is weird because they're slow and they're sort of boring looking a lot of the time. I mean, mycelium.
They're not that boring.
Mycelium is just white junk.
We
you know?
saw We actually saw yellow and blue oyster mushrooms.
That's true. At the
and
end.
And lion's mane. Those don't look boring.
That's true, but I think most of their life you just have to care for like a big sack of white crap. And then at the end, yeah, you get this spray, this bouquet of yellow. But yeah, I was just impressed by that, I guess, that they had real commitments to thinking about the environment and what better diets might look like for people who have traditionally eaten a lot of meat and are then considering mushrooms as this new thing, which of course they're not new.
Yeah.
But they might be new to some eaters. And they also, yeah, dealt with the material reality of something heavy and slow and just very, very different from a plant or a human. What did you learn? What did you sort of find surprising or informative?
I definitely agree that they all kind of came, or maybe came to mushrooms through this culinary way, right? So JJ grew up with mushrooms growing up in Shanghai. Wild Man Steve Brill really loved mushrooms, especially in like mushroom chocolate. I would say Andrew, actually, I don't know if Andrew talked about eating mushrooms that much, but I'm sure he does.
He definitely was very focused on business.
And then Regina definitely did.
Oh, yeah.
She actually made me want to try all of those mushrooms. And it seemed like that was her passion.
Yeah. And I definitely think people had different stories about how they thought of the same organism. So basically, we focused on, you could say, oyster mushrooms, and almost everyone had a different way of narrating it, whether it was about focusing on sort of a product that has a certain value. Regina really focused on taste and how to cook them, and are you cooking them the best way? She was so excited about that. And then Wildman definitely gave us a lot of food, including some mushrooms, but he really lit up, I think, when we went to see his kind of magic like collection of life specimens that he'd sculpted. And then I think, all the stories came out. And I thought that was really telling, that to him, these were amazing objects that kind of come and go and you don't totally have control over. It's the kind of thing someone says who's really into improv jazz and transcendental meditation. I mean, it sort of fit that he almost didn't want to grow them, because why would you do that at all? You just walk outside and whatever's outside, that's what you eat.
Yeah. It's like it's an adventure for him, because even when he's just walking to the pool, walking to go right. swimming or exercising, he's going to possibly run into these mushrooms.
Right. And JJ had I think we both were just so impressed with her take that was so focused in ecological thought and just saying that by caring for this organism, it's also sort of making me do things. So it's sort of, I describe it as a pet. She described it as a boss, which I thought was so interesting. So these little spores that don't even move. She sort of viewed as her boss, because if she didn't take care of them, they'd die, and then she wouldn't get any mushrooms. Also, she would feel bad. And that sort of was the first, I think it was like the first
story
she told us.
I think that was the main thing.
Peter McCoy giving her, you know, liquid spores.
Yeah. And that there are this living thing.
Yeah.
That she was then, just had to take care of this living thing, and she couldn't let them die.
Right, right. Absolutely.
So mushrooms are products to grow because you could sell them. But they are also unique living things that help you connect with other living things. And, of course, mushrooms are delicious food. Plus, we haven't even mentioned psychoactive mushrooms.
We could devote whole episodes to each of these reasons for growing or seeking out exotic mushrooms in cities, and we probably will at some point. But for now, let's give the final word to JJ.
There's part of us, it's inside of us already, that we don't need to create or make additional so that people have it. It's inside of us. We just have to wake it up.
Thanks to our amazing guests, Andrew Carter, Regina Bellows, Wildman Steve Brill, and Ji Jin. And a big thanks to Andrew Carter for letting us use his amazing cello music.
Field's theme music is by Sam Tyndall.
Our amazing producing engineer at Heritage Radio Network is Liam Warner.
Fields is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org,
Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork.
Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.